Welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics, 5 days a week. I'm Seth Jevil. Listeners to The Bunker always like a laugh, because with the state of the news, if you don't laugh, you'll have to cry. But comedy can be a very serious business, and a new book looks at the history of the British comic tradition over the last 130 years or so. I'm joined today by David Stubbs, sometime music journalist and author of Different Times, A History of British Comedy. Welcome to The Bunker, David.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
David, maybe I'd like to start just by asking, what do you look for in good comedy?
That's an interesting question, really, because, I mean, I think there's a range, really. I mean, on the one hand, an absolute pure belly laugh, you know, can be a great, great thing. But I think that especially these days, comedy is kind of comedy plus. There's a sort of other things going on, you know, like, you know, think of like Gone Fishing, you know, with Maud Brown Whitehouse. I think there's comedy, but there's also a sort of, a sense of like looking out for people's mental health. You know, it's been one of its kind of contemporary details, you know. Some other comedy has a great sense of inclusivity and range, you know, because I think that in the past, comedy has been guilty of not really, you know, of punching down and not being inclusive. And historically, you know, sometimes you do enter the title of the book, Different Times, you know, it's obviously it's a pun, you know, it's, oh, there were different times. Not all comedy has really survived in terms of its values. And I think that it would actually genuinely alienate, you know, a lot of young people if they sort of saw the stuff that, say, I grew up with and took for granted in, say, the 1970s. So, yeah, it's a range, really. You know, sometimes, yes, it just can be the sort of the flat out, no politics, whatever, no problem, of a Tommy Cooper. Or it could be something like The Detectorists, you know, which is much more than comedy going on. It's ostensibly comedy, but there's more going on.
Thinking about those sort of different times, I mean, going back to the very earliest roots, the British music hall tradition casts a very big shadow, and you get these major figures, you know, from Laurel and Hardy to Peter Sellers coming out of that. But it's had a really rough time in terms of its reputation in recent years. You know, the whole thing about Blackadder having a go at music halls and how primitive and unfunny they are.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I think, I suppose it's because, you know, there was just sort of dealing in very kind of, you know, basic stock types, whatever. It was just the beginning, really, you know, crude knockabout sort of class-based comedy. But you can see the kind of roots of, like, you know, like British comedy did probably develop from these very kind of crude stock types and, you know, the kind of the swells and Dorks and Mercy and all that and the kind of brown boots and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I suppose these were the kind of the rude beginnings. And also, I suppose, there was a versatility required. I mean, Charlie Chaplin couldn't just have been like a stand-up or whatever. You know, he had to do, you know, the whole range of skills, you know, acrobatic and what have you. And, there is that as well. And especially, you know, obviously in the silent days, you know, those things would have been paramount.
How easy is it for comedy to be timeless? Because if I look at something like Hancock's Half Hour from the 1950s, I mean, the comic acting is superb. Mm. But certainly I think a modern viewer would find, you know, when they're used to very heavily caffeinated performers going at 120 miles an hour and they're used to fast cutting and fast pacing, that's not the case at all.
Yeah, that can be difficult. I mean, especially, I mean, you mentioned Laurel and Hardy. I mean, this is the difference, I think. I mean, I grew up in the sort of, I was born in 1962. So I started being kind of sentient and watching television perhaps in the early 70s. And back then, you had everything. You had the 1920s represented by documents like Golden Silence. You had Charlie Chaplin was on the TV all the time. Laurel and Hardy had the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, all regularly on television, you know, as well as the contemporary stuff. But these days, you look at TV, if you look at TV at all, a lot of kids don't bother, you know, they don't. And it's a kind of everything, it's a sort of permanent. Nothing feels like it's more than 6 weeks old. It's very hard. You know, you really have to sort of make an effort to go and access anything, I don't know, from sort of Tommy Cooper to Hancock, as you mentioned. You have to make an active effort to do it. You don't just collide with it the way that I did as a kid. I always imagined that someone like Charlie Chaplin would just be forever fixed in the firmament, but he's not. And I think the problem kids have is quite simply, you know, the black and whiteness for a start. You know, the sort of production values of those kind of like short 20-minute films, you know, where there's sometimes the soundtrack, you know, disappears and it's just this sort of this crackle going on. And I remember like showing it to my little nephew and he just stared coldly at me and he went, "What is this?"
Well, it's. I wonder if it's just the black and whiteness because, you know, there have been colorizations around since the 1980s.
Yeah.
But there's something about if the production values are really bad, if it's a really bad print, that it's a lot of work to go through, it stops being funny.
Yeah, I mean, it probably does, unfortunately, for kids. You know, in the way that, like, if you listen to sort of old, very old blues records, you know, or old Bessie Smith records, you get none of the sense of the power that she projected.
Yeah. it's easy to see why sort of visual comedy, like, you know, Charlie Chaplin, Benny Hill, Mr. Bean, translates abroad quite well. But then you get these things like Allo Allo and the Ealing comedies and the Carry On films. I don't mean to suggest they're all alike, but they're all very British. But they do seem to have translated abroad really well and had their own sort of global audience in different ways.
So, yeah, in different ways. I'm not so sure about the international reach of the Carry On films. You know, they are definitely British. But, I mean, you know, it's surprising sometimes these things have a kind of slightly kind of niche thing. Yeah, it's an interesting question as to what travels and what doesn't. I mean, to be honest, the fact that Benny Hill had such a great international, especially in America, has astonished me because quite often I was in the Gramsci Park Hotel in New York once and there was this old couple sitting laughing, watching this Benny Hill thing that was being projected on this big TV screen. They were just laughing away. And I thought, how can you be finding this funny? To find this funny, you'd have to know all about Molly Weir, who was the star of the Flash adverts in the UK in the 1960s. If you don't know that, I don't know what you're laughing at. It's very strange. I think that Benny Hill made it because of the format, because he did things in that long. It happened to be usable in American TV in the way that, like, a lot of British stuff wasn't. And so that travelled. But then Morecambe and Wise didn't travel, you know. And Hancock never really made it and things like that. And it's strange, you know, the ones that do and the ones that don't.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, things like Allo Allo and even Are You Being Served. I mean, it's huge in Germany. Really, really big.
Yeah. I mean, that is curious. Allo Allo is very strange because I think it's very clever in the way that it kind of plays with sort of British ideas of foreignness and foreign accents, whatever. Yeah. It just seems to be pretty much all about that, really, in you know? Are You Being Served is a curious case. It's a bit delicate. It's a bit sort of creaky. And it's very much a sort of product of the British mindset in lots of ways, with this kind of cheek, but ultimately sort of deference towards, you know, class and authority.
In its defence, it doesn't pretend to be anything that it's not. But at the same time, you know, for anyone who's ever sought out the movie they made of Are You Being Served, I think it may be one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's dreadful. Yes, yeah. Obviously, in the 70s, there were a lot of films based on sitcoms. And yeah, one or two of them are pretty bad. And so generally, as a result of like things like that and the Holiday on the Buses and stuff like that, they have a poor reputation. But in fact, quite often, some of them were really, really good. So, for example, the film made of The Likely Lads in 1976 was just called The Likely Lads, based on, you know, whatever happened to The Likely Lads. Probably the best thing they ever did. It's the funniest thing they ever did. The Dad's Army film is great. And the first Steptoe and Son film in particular is almost like a tragic comedy. It's absolutely magnificent. Porridge film, also great. Yeah.
Yes. And then, bizarrely, of course, On the Buses ends up being one of the most successful movies that Hammer Horrors, Hammer Studios have ever put out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it's so sort of creaky and dodgy that you can almost develop an affection for it, really. I mean, it's actually On the Buses, it's bad in so many ways, but it's actually the ensemble cast is quite good, really, quite strong. Also, it's a reasonably authentic depiction of, like, working class life and people having to sort of live cheek by jowl in very sort of cramped conditions.
I can see that, but at the same time, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar with On the Buses, and I really don't urge you to go and watch it, it's basically a group of bus conductors in the station discussing how they've been molesting people for the day and how they're proposing to molest them in the day ahead.
That's a large part of it.
Serious question for you, which is that we do tend to think of the best of British comedy. You know, we tend to think of something like Fawlty Towers. And we don't tend to think of, you know, these sort of mediocre sitcoms of the 70s you sort of point to in the book, things that have often been forgotten that make up a large part of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is it, because it was staple. And it so happened that I would have been a kid at the time and I would have watched all of this stuff regardless, and quite uncritically as well. You know, as far as I was concerned when I was a kid, you know, if pop music was fast, then that was great. And if something was on with a sort of laugh track, then great, whatever. And I was a fairly undiscerning watcher, but it did actually mean that I kind of was familiar, you know, with a great many of these shows.
I mean, I'm fascinated by this actually as a historian, because it gives you a good yardstick for what's popular culture and what's normal and what's not at a particular time. But, you know, that gives me a slightly detached way of looking at it. And so some of them I enjoy very much and some of them I do think this is truly awful.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, they're distinctly creaky. And of course, you know, with what I describe in the book as like the fish bones, you know, the odd moment of like racism or homophobia or whatever. But, you know, you get actually you get that right up into sort of, you know, like the goodies, you know, and all the blackface that goes on in the goodies, for example. And even actually quite often something like Monty Python, you know, great as it is, I think precisely because it was attempting to be quite edgy, a lot of Monty Python actually looks a bit dodgy these days. You know, well, not really, I say a lot, but you know, there are definitely dodgy bits, put it that way.
Yeah, not just Monty Python, but even thinking something like Spitting Image, I think, suffers from are remembering the very best of it. And usually you'd sort of watch an episode and find there was something that was absolutely hysterical that has you laughing out loud. And then there are two or three things that are quite funny. And a lot of it's not very good. How important do you think it is for comedy to connect with the audience? Because on the one hand, there are things like, you know, Steptoe and Son, you mentioned, Only Fools and Horses, The Royal Family. They really try and reflect everyday normal experiences that the audiences have. And then you look at something like, you know, historical things like Blackadder or even Up Pompeii or something like Red Dwarf, where the setting is so out there. You do ask yourself, how easy is it for the audience to connect with the characters?
Well, I think, you know, almost it's precisely the idea of someone like, say, Blackadder. I think that, like, the Blackadder character is somebody that's kind of, you almost imagine, has been sort of transposed from the 20th century. With kind of contemporary sort of art and values and things, you know, surrounded by these kind of ridiculous pantomime characters and medieval monsters or whatever. I think that's where the connection is. I think he's the vital connection there. Yeah, and I guess other series or whatever, I think it's a way, you know, despite, you know, like Red Dwarf or whatever, you know, despite its kind of setting, its kind of thing, is that in terms of the actual characters and the way that they talk, you know, there is this kind of amusing disconnect between the down-to-earthness, as it were, when they're talking and their particular situation. So, yeah, you know, I think it's really, really important. It's interesting because I think that comedy over the years has become better and better at doing what you just mentioned, which is, you know, reflecting life as it's actually lived. Because I think for a long time, even the best comedy did quite often deal in stock types, whether it was, you know, from mother-in-laws to gays or whatever, you know, those kind of things.
Suburban households.
Poor, you know. Very poor, especially Asian people getting desperately poorly represented. And all of this improved. And I think that one of the great catalysts for that was what was in the late 70s, what was a sort of an equivalent to like the whole punk thing in the UK, was alternative comedy. And gradually, the impact of that was the same as the impact that it had in music, where it's kind of driving out the old sort of dinosaurs of prog rock and stuff like that, and sort of, you know, saying we have to kind of rethink the way that we make music and who gets to make music, and, you know, and it being about kind of like ideas rather than these kind of, you know, these like monstrous kind of prog conceits. So in terms of alternative comedy, essentially what it was saying to people is, look, you can't have the mother-in-law jokes, you can't have the racism, you can't have the sexism, you can't have, you know, all of the ableism, whatever. So all up to another generation might say, oh, very soon, no, we can't laugh at anything. But the whole point is, no, you have to think harder and do better. And the result of that, people, it was a genuine, especially coming in the 90s, there's a genuine flowering of comedy that was more nuanced, that was more inclusive, that was more imaginative, that reflected situations, that was more original, and that sort of did away with all of these kind of sort of lazy stock types that had just been around since basically the music of days in some cases. And whether it was the surrealism of like Vic and Bob, Vic Reeves, Bob Mortimer, or the almost like super realism of like The Royal Family, people, audiences were able to kind of make a much stronger connection because they were working harder to create a comedy that really reflected, you know, the sort of like sometimes the sort of funny little details and nuances of how life is really lived and how people think and feel.
I want to ask a bit about alternative comedy because it's often, you know, said it's a real watershed, and certainly there's a change in generations. You know, you've got people like Ben Elton and Alexei Sale who are very different as comedians. But at the same time, if you look at some of the comedy, like, you know, Not the 9 o'clock News, is very much the building on bits of Monty Python. It's still that same kind of humour. So I wonder if it's that big a disconnect.
Well, yeah, I mean, Not the 9 o'clock News is interestingly because, yeah, I mean, there isn't that much of a disconnect really between Not the 9 o'clock News and, say, Monty Python. It's perhaps in that almost like in that sort of footlightsy tradition. But I mean, I would put Not the 9 o'clock News at more of the, well, conservative is probably not quite the right word, but I think that the real kind of anarcho revolution is the young ones, you know. And I think the way that just kind of explodes the whole kind of medium, literally quite often, you know, there's walls collapsing in it, all over, literally in that house the whole time, and it's metaphorically walls are collapsing, and you know, all it is.
Thatcher does loom large over a lot of this.
I mean, absolutely,
to which she's crucified on a daily basis by Ben Elton, for instance.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was a whole sort of, I think in music as well, and in comedy, yeah, there was this sort of what seemed like a massive counter reaction. But of course, in terms of numbers, I mean, you know, she had the numbers of when it came to election time.
Yeah, but it was a new kind of establishment to rebel against.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's ironic, really, with the dominant and excellent political comedy of the 80s was Yes Minister / Yes Prime Minister. And yet, in a way, funny as it is, it's like politics, it's almost like talking about the politics that existed in the, I don't know, the Wilson, the Callaghan, or the Heath years, really, in which there's a sort of awkward consensus, and at the end of the episode, a sort of normalcy is restored, stability and equilibrium is restored as far as that keeps the civil service happy anyway, et cetera, et cetera. But, of course, what was actually happening was something very different. I mean, Thatcher was kind of really sort of, you know, rolling back the frontiers of the welfare state, et cetera, introducing all kind of radical change, you know. Mm. So it's ironic that the dominant political comedy was actually about 10 years behind the times.
Yeah, and, of course, Thatcher herself considered herself to be a Yes Minister fan.
I'm sure she liked it because, you know, she was actually dismantling all of the kind, you know, she was like at war, you know, with Sir Humphreys.
But I think you're right that since the 80s, certainly there's really been a sort of sea change in the kind of comedy and the kind of voices that you get in comedy as well. It's really noticeable. We mentioned a bit things like Spitting Image and not the 9 o'clock news, and I'm a really big fan of satire, and a lot of this really feeds into is the idea of comedy with a point. But how difficult is it to balance out making a point with just going for the cheap laugh?
It isn't easy, and I think that satire from a comedic point of view represents a kind of an invidious task, really. And I think quite often the satirists themselves don't necessarily seem interested. Some of the great satirists have also been great conservatives in lots of way, and not particularly interested in, revolutionary transformation of society or whatever. And in fact, you know, the people attempting that are quite often the biggest butts of the satire, really, you know. I mean, something like when Spitting Image came back, I mean, this reboot, and I thought was an absolute disaster. And part of it was that the caricatures they created of people like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, if anything, flattered them. Politics has almost become such a kind of monstrous caricature of itself, and it's become so kind of excessive and so driven to the far right that satire, what can you do?
I mean, laughter is a form of release, and the question is, you know, do we need a release or not?
Yeah, there are kind of very hostile forces in society that are kind of making people's lives miserable in all kinds of ways. I mean, you know, from capitalism to the kind of politics that's been the cruelty of Suella Braverman or whatever. And I think that comedy is therefore isn't necessarily to sort of fight back in a satirical role. It's, as I was saying earlier on, it's to look out for people. It's to exude a sort of kindness, a sort of radical kindness, really. It's to think about issues like mental health. It's to think about everybody feeling included, nobody being punched down at, you know. Those are the things that I think that comedy can do and can do most effectively.
No, I think that's fair. And when I think of examples of that being done well or badly, I mean, someone like Sacha Baron Cohen is both very good and very bad at different times.
Yes, I mean,
For instance, looking at the way he uses Borat, sometimes he brilliantly uses the sort of prejudices of people to make that come out. But at the same time, on a superficial level, you do feel sometimes that he's just going for the cheap laugh of, I'm a foreigner with a funny accent, and that's going to please a certain number of viewers.
I think that's absolutely right. I think he's done some absolutely brilliant stuff as Sacha Baron Cohen. But yeah, and he's done, you know, there's one, you know, the old man who's retired, and he says, you are retard, you know. And it's just like, if that had been my dad, I wouldn't have been best pleased.
You've talked quite a bit in the book about how we tackle race and comedy. I mean, we already touched on how that's getting a bit better. How much is that something peculiar to the way the British tackle comedy, or is it, you know, a global problem, really?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that, like in America, which I suppose is the great sort of other comic tradition that we're most familiar with, you know, there's been a kind of similarish trajectory, really, you know, that if you look at the history of comedy, about the gradual introduction of African-American characters, people of colour, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, with Till Death Us Do Part, I mean, it was terrible because you're supposed to be dealing with a racist character, but there was barely any black people at all, you know, represented. You know, they couldn't bring themselves to have, like, I mean, there was a slightly later reboot of the Alf Garnett character where he has this kind of gay black sort of guy who, you know, acts as a kind of housekeeper for him, but, you know, it just seems a bit kind of, you know.
And then he moved to something like in the 1990s growing up. I remember seeing Goodness Gracious Me and thinking, I don't think this is very funny, but it feels very different and, you know, something that's really actually very welcome.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the format, I mean, I did enjoy Goodness Gracious Me, you know, and it's like going out for an English. You know, yeah, I went the blandest item on the menu, yeah. It didn't, from a sort of formal point of view, I don't think it was especially radical. But of course, yeah, what was radical, what was new is that it had, you know, it had an Asian cast. And they were kind of addressing issues that arise, you know, from Asian society, you know, and Asian families and stuff like that, making jokes that kind of arise from all of that. You know, the mother that thinks she can make everything from a small aubergine and
the
whatever.
Only thing that didn't work for me is the same reason actually why I never took to look at Little Britain, which is just catchphrase-based comedy. It does get a bit repetitive and a bit tiresome quite quickly. But, you know, catchphrase-based comedy has been a huge part of our, you know, life for decades.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have nothing against catchphrase-based comedy at all. Yeah, Dad's Army, you know.
Yes, quite. I mean, there are plenty of debates that we now have on, you know, is comedy going woke? Is it too woke? I can remember in the 1990s we had exactly the same debates over, you know, what we called at the time political correctness. Yeah. I don't think this has ever not been present in one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so in the 1990s people talk about political correctness. Today, as say, we talk about woke. Before political correctness, people talked about do-gooders or whatever. I mean, this is just the sort of, you know, the Daily Mail machine that's kind of like grinding away resentfully at any attempt to kind of improve people's lives. I don't think there's a problem with wokeness. I mean, John Cleese made this point. He says, you know, who's gone a bit reactionary in his later years. And he said something like, what would a woke joke sound like? And the thing is, it's not like there was that sketch in the Fast Show, the character Bernard Wright on, like, you know, goes on stage, says, an Englishman, an Irishman, a Pakistani walk into a bar. What a wonderful example of racial integration. Yeah. You know, but that's not what a woke joke is all about. It's about the absence of anything that's likely to be kind of upsetting, hurtful, needlessly punching down or offensive or whatever. I mean, pretty much all of Tommy Cooper, it's all woke jokes, you know.
Yes.
You know, what you want there is a Rembrandt and Stradivarius, you know, unfortunately. Yeah. That's fine. It's a woke joke because it's very, very funny and it is without sin, as it were, you know.
And we've changed the setting of comedy a little bit. I mean, if we think back to the sort of music hall roots of this, there used to be a live audience, and then in the early days of television, there was a live audience. We got very used to the idea of canned laughter to being, you know, almost a cliche. And now we've moved to no laughter track at all. Are we getting lonelier in our comedy?
The laugh track is a fascinating thing because when the Royal Family first emerged, they had to fight really hard to say, no, don't put a laugh track on this, you know. And they were quite right, and absolutely it was quite right, because it then allows this kind of more naturalistic, detailed comedy with its own particular kind of rhythms. You don't have to spike every 10 or 15 seconds to have a big laugh. So it allows for a complete, you know, a much different kind of comedy that, like, breathes more naturally. It has its own rhythm and its own sort of cadence. You know, there's episodes where there's just lots and lots of repetition. And, you know, it's really, really funny. And a laugh track would just ruin that. And, yeah, we've moved more, we tend but to the extent that now, if you, I don't know, say a Lee Max sitcom, something like that, and then where it still retains a laugh track, it sounds quite surreal, really. You know, you sort of jump, you know, who are those people, you know?
Well, also, I suppose we've all unconsciously become quite used to the laugh track.
Yeah.
Because there aren't actually that many laughter effects, and they're all on cue and on demand for a set amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, there's definitely been a tendency away from the laugh track. Of course, there is. I mean, it might well be that, say, in 10 years' time, that the whole idea of this kind of naturalistic comedy, the, like, detectorists, you know, there's a lot of comedy being made in this vein, it'll feel, well, that's actually a bit spent, really. Can we get back to something different? You know, so it could all change.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you so much, David. David's rip-roaring romp through over a century of laughter is Different Times, A History of British Comedy, and is available from all good booksellers and Amazon. Thank you for joining us, dear listeners. You'll find us 5 days a week, every week. And if you enjoy the podcast, remember you can support us on Patreon from just £3 a month. You'll be supporting our ever-expanding catalogue of shows, including The Bunker, Oh God, What Now?, and Paper Cuts. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Seth Tevel.
I'm so sorry, he's from Barcelona.
Group editor was Andrew Harrison.
Oh, you dirty old man.
The managing editor was Jacob Jarvis.
What a plonker.
And the producers were Liam Tate and me, Alex Rees.
You stupid bum.
Art direction by James Parrott. Music by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.